Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And we're back with our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. And joining us are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute think tank, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Hurston of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back. I was having roundtable withdrawal symptoms, so thanks very much for making time for us today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Iron Mike, let's start with you. GOP's skinny stimulus measure that looked like an election year cover your butt effort to sort of say, hey, we're doing something about the stimulus and the Democrats wouldn't let us do it. It's their fault, not ours. Where are we on pretty much everything? Because it's been about 2 weeks and we have had the Senate vote. And I also want to get your take on the status of the Buy American language that was in there. Obviously, an appeal from our closest allies for the United States not to do that, to require 100% of American weapons content to be American made. Dove wrote a thoughtful piece on that and AI as well. So Dove, want to get you to weigh in a little bit as well, but sort of bring us up to speed on where we are.
Okay, so not much has changed on the authorization bill. Right now, that conference is moving along very well. In fact, the first meeting of what's considered the little four, the staff directors for the chairman and ranking members, is supposed to happen next Friday. So even though I think the conference is moving along pretty well, we still don't anticipate seeing a bill until after the election. My understanding is the appropriators in the Senate will release their marks in early October. So, but those bills will not go to the floor because they will not have time because they'll be leaving for election. So, all eyes really are back on where we stand with coronavirus relief and then a possible or likely CR. So, as we all know, the Democrats passed a $3.4 trillion package about 4 months ago in the House, but the Republicans in the Senate decided to take more of a wait and see approach. And as time went on, they decided they needed to do something. They really had a hard time coalescing around a dollar figure and what they wanted to put in it. First, they had a $1 trillion package. Then they went down to a $500 billion skinny package. And then the package that was voted on yesterday was about a $600 billion, again, skinny package, which really just added extra $300 in extra employment insurance benefits instead of the $600 people are getting now. It made some changes to Paycheck Protection Program. It gave some money for schools, farmers and ranchers that are hurt, some money for vaccines, and some loan forgiveness for the Postal Service, since that's been a hot issue lately, and the liability protections that McConnell has been pushing for. However, again, notably absent was the money for defense spending and the extension of Section 3610, which was in the House bill and defense contractors have been pushing for. Anyway, no surprise, the bill did fail yesterday. The Democrats were able to successfully filibuster the bill. And that's been the handwriting on the wall all week. Leaders in both parties have been telegraphing that this bill was not going to pass. I mean, in fact, Schumer said on Wednesday, look, this bill's not going to pass. I'm going to be right back where we are today. He called the bill emaciated, attacked it for not having important things that Democrats feel were important: housing assistance, nutrition assistance, of course, the aid to state and local governments. The Republicans counter that the Democrats really care more about hurting the Trump than they do about dealing with the crisis. But the upside for Republicans is that out of 53 Republican senators, 52 voted for the package. And that really helps some of these vulnerable Republican senators go home and campaign to say that they actually did vote for a relief package. But it really seems like both sides are willing to head into the election, which is 50 plus days away, really without another bill and just playing the blame game. Now, all comments have been very pessimistic. Mnuchin's comments the other day were just, I don't know, we'll see. Senator Pat Roberts on appropriations said we're really at a dead end street. And the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Richard Shelby, said, negotiations really seem to be dead. So House Democrats, even though they did pass a bill 4 months ago, many of the Democrats who won GOP seats are feeling very nervous. They feel they need to continue to put relief bills on the floor during the time that they're here. And the leadership in the House has been divided on that. Hoyer actually liked that idea, but Pelosi and Schumer shot that down. They don't want the piecemeal approach. In fact, Pelosi said she does not want to be considered a cheap date. And to add to that anxiety, the House is planning on voting on legalizing marijuana in September. So vulnerable Democrats are saying, hey, look, if we're going to be voting on legalizing marijuana, we really should be voting on things dealing with the pandemic. So a lot remains to be seen, but there really is no optimism that anything actually will pass the House and the Senate and be signed into law. So the only good news is that both sides seem to have agreed that they will pass a continuing resolution to keep the government funded and avoid a government shutdown in September. And the only rub there is the timeline. Democrats now are pushing for February, and the Republicans are pushing for sometime in December. I personally believe that the deadline will be December, and if they can't think of what happens to the election, they will can then extend the CR into next year, into February or March. The downside, too, here is that once a CR is passed in September, there really is no incentive to stick around. So even though they are supposed to be here into early October, my guess is that they give back that time and then go home and campaign.
Byron, let me just ask you, you've been writing a lot of thoughtful notes and you've been paying attention to all of this, right? I mean, we've got a little bit of a yin and yang happening here, where on the one hand, the rate of fatalities has slowed. We're seeing more cases or even caseload numbers, right? I mean, it's very, very hard to look at the statistics on this. There are some Americans who are saying, look, this really has passed. You do see fewer masks in some places, depending on where you are, or no masks at all, or people getting together for dinner, and more sort of intimate events at the same time when some of the immunologists, Dr. Fauci, but others have been saying, look, we could see a real surge in cases, especially as we go into the winter, and then you have flu season and all of that. How do you see this dynamic situation as we're going into it, you know, budgetarily, debt-wise, campaign-wise, and otherwise? And then I want to, you know, sort of get everybody's take on it as well.
Well, look, one of the other hats I wear is I follow infrastructure issues as well as defense. And I think, you know, that's been another theme that's kind of been missing in action for the last couple of years. But I think the thing that doesn't really get called out enough here, it's certainly true at a state and local level, but just is the damage that's occurring at state and local revenues. And that had been one of the biggest gaps between the House HEROES Act and what the Senate had been talking about. So I think, you know, as this wears on, I think 46 states have fiscal years that ended in June. So we're kind of on the new fiscal years for most of the states in the country. The blows had been cushioned to some extent from COVID-19 because a lot of states had rainy day funds. And if you look at kind of the concerns that are starting to emerge about the damage that's going to be done to 2021 and 2022 spending plans, it's real. And no one knows, you know, what the resurgence of COVID could look like in the fall and possibly next year. But I think, you know, that's probably going to be the most important thing to watch. I kind of agree with Michael's characterization. You know, Washington seems content to punt on this. I think people believe that they're going to, you know, score points with their respective bases by doing so. But there's a looming problem here, and ultimately it's going to cause more money to fix, and that's something that can bear on defense spending.
Gordon?
Well, I think what's interesting here is anybody who continues to be shocked that we have politics going on in this place really ought to leave the stadium. We're in election campaign, no secret here, and we're playing a game of budgetary and COVID chicken between the Democrats and the Republicans, finger-pointing, blame game. It's not Washington politics as usual. It's Washington every 4 years election politics as usual in a highly contentious year. So I think both sides appear to me to be calculating, taking the risk that if the Republicans point at Democratic inaction, they can blame the Democrats. Democrats passing their bill in the House can point their finger at the Republicans for passing something skinny that doesn't deal with the problem at the state and local and individual level. it's politics, group. This is exactly what's going on. And it is a game of chicken on the backs of the American people in the middle of the COVID crisis. But that's what's going on here.
I think I am one of the people who finds that there ought to be some way to figure this out, given the magnitude of the challenge. I understand what Democrats are saying at the end of the day. Let's have this be comprehensive. And there's a lot of economic data to suggest that actually, if you spend more earlier, faster, why did the United States recover better than a lot of other countries around the world? Because we were not as austere in our stimulus plans. If we had been even less austere than we were, the rebound would have been even stronger. But putting that aside, Mackenzie, you want to get your take and then Dove, yours.
Right. So there's no doubt that Pentagon leaders are worried, to Byron's point. And they see the writing on the wall. They know what's coming. And you heard that reflected in various public engagements that Pentagon officials had throughout the week. So, for example, at the Defense News Conference, Deputy Secretary of Defense David Norquist touted the achievements of this administration at the Pentagon, as well as Secretary Esper and all the work that they've done to reverse the impacts of sequestration and the Budget Control Act and readiness crisis that they inherited, et cetera. And he took on Bernie Sanders and others who want to cut the top line and talked about the damage that would do. But then in other panels, you heard General Hinote from the Air Force talk about how, for example, you know, this reform review called Night Court that's, you know, been underway for 2 years by Secretary Esper, first in the Army and then as Secretary of Defense. It's over for fiscal year 2022, but he was talking about how basically it's, you know, they're continuing work in the 23 budget, and every year these decisions get harder. They find less and less things that are, you know, the low-hanging fruit is gone. While they have priorities based on the strategy that help, there are absolute losers, and they are going to be self-evident pretty soon, I guess, when the new budget drops, and that everyone should brace themselves. Oh, Bago, I want to say one piece of good news to Michael's comments on the National Defense Authorization Act. Having spent some time with the majority staff on the House side last week, the good news is there really aren't a lot of hangups. There's only like five or six issues that are even going to make it to the big four, the members. And the only reason that this is even getting kicked past the election is just simply due to the issue with the president, which is the naming or the renaming of Confederate military bases and installations. Otherwise, this one's going to sail through relative to last year.
And we're going to talk about this in a moment, but former Vice President Biden also had an interview in Stars and Stripes where he talked about the fact that, you know, he's not going to be interested in, you know, given the global competitive environment the nation finds itself in, that, you know, big defense cuts are not going to be in the offing, and actually talked about a China policy that's remarkably similar to what the Trump administration has been talking about. Dove, let's go to you for your insights on this, because I know that you've also been talking to senior leadership in the Pentagon about all of these issues.
Well, one thing that I was told, and it is interesting, is that normally when you get a new person at the top, the first thing they do is disavow everything that came before them. Every new general has his or her own 100-day plan, which implies that the predecessor was an idiot. What's happened in the last few years since Mattis came up with a defense strategy based on the national security strategy, the first thing that a new secretary says is, I'm sticking to it. And even though there may be lots of questions about, okay, once you go beyond that, where do you go? The fact that at least there's a framework that seems to be holding is pretty important. And so wherever the budget goes, and I think we've all agreed that it'll remain flat, I think the real message of Mr. Biden is that it's not going to go down. There's none of this 10% cut, not a 5% cut. We're not talking about that. And that's terribly important. It's an important signal to our Chinese and Russian adversaries. But it's going to be within an agreed framework. Nobody is challenging the notion that Russia and China are the problem. So that's really, really important, I think. To me, the question that we've been addressing up to now is, in terms of overall spending beyond just defense, I think it really rests on what happens to this pandemic. And there are examples from two small countries which demonstrate that what happens with us can go either way. The Israelis started off really well And seem to have the whole pandemic under control. And now they're losing more people, I think, per day than any other country on a relative basis. Obviously, not as much as India, but relatively speaking. And they've totally lost control and the whole country's on lockdown again. On the other hand, the Swedes, who got started off with this herd stuff that people weren't sure about, and then things went bad and they got criticized and the prime minister's popularity went all the way down. Now they're looking up. So we just don't know what will happen here in a country of 350 million people. The thing is, it's not going to happen before Election Day. We're 5 weeks away. I mean, and we're still probably in phase one. So that's not going to affect the election, I don't think. And in any event, I think people have made up their minds whether they're more scared about rioters in the suburbs or more scared about education and health and so on. They've made their minds up. The real question is what happens after that? Because if indeed the virus reemerges in a very powerful way, that's going to skew a lot of programs, and that might force whoever is president to look a lot more closely at how much we spend on defense, not because they want to cut, but because their hand might be forced.
Michael, let me go to you and get anybody else's comments on this, looking at Vice President Biden's statements. I was talking to somebody who was a senior Trump defense official who looked at it, you know, encouragingly. You know, he said, look, I expected that that's where Biden's mind would be. You know, he said it was reassuring to try to see that. It speaks a little bit to the continuity that Dove is talking about. I mean, is that sort of, you know, is that the consensus view, given how many members you're talking to up there, that there is a recognition that you know, defense spending should stay as stable as possible, and that we really have crossed a China Rubicon here, where whatever policy will be tougher? I mean, in fact, there was one person I talked to who thought that Biden actually would organize government a little bit more comprehensively than perhaps this administration has been on China.
Well, I think first—
consistently.
Look, I think first it means, what does it mean to keep defense spending stable? So, as you know, if this year's defense spending is going to be about $740 billion for a fiscal year 21. So if we stay at $740 billion going into fiscal year 22, just like going from 738 last year to 741 this year, it appears to be an increase, but it's really a reduction because you're not taking inflation into consideration. So I think even if we stay flat, not adjusted for inflation, people will still see that as a win. And I do think that Biden's hands are going to be tied, because as he comes in, he's going to have to be dealing still with the coronavirus crisis, not only with the healthcare side, but also with the economic impact. And by cutting defense spending will only add to the nation's economic woes. And Democrats I've talked to on the Hill recognize that if we cut defense, those cuts come out of procurement and R&D, and those are jobs, and that's additional layoffs. Democratic leaders in the House have assured me that they are opposed to deep cuts in defense. Even though I think we saw Senate leaders sign on to a 10% cut, I think a lot of that was more messaging than reality.
Byron, why don't you go, and then Gordon, let's go to you, because I think you do want to weigh in on this conversation as well.
Well, look, this is kind of a typical Washington, D.C. discussion about what is flat. Is flat growing at the rate of inflation? Is flat at $740 billion? Because flat either way really still shows some pretty substantial cuts, particularly in the investment accounts. And I know McKenzie, you know, referenced some of the conferences and events that were streamed this past week. And that was a pretty interesting theme that I heard a lot of people talk about, was the trade-offs that the Department of Defense is really starting to consider. You know, how do you get out of these older legacy systems to fund investment in newer programs? Are some of the newer technologies kind of battlefield ready to deploy with confidence? And so I think that's really the most interesting issue below the level of where the total level of spending is going to be, is what are the trades that are going to start to emerge in a flat budget environment, be it flat current or flat real? There have to be cuts relative to current investment plans if that's a scenario that plays out.
Gordon, and then McKenzie, please.
I thought the Biden intervention was interesting, certainly for the fact that, not surprisingly, he fingered Russia and China as major security issues the U.S. would have to deal with in a Biden administration. But I thought it was interesting on the defense side in particular, because he was advertising no cuts, and he said it could even increase in a Biden administration. And he underlined points that I know one of his advisors, Michel Flournoy, has underlined before, which is the next generation technology investment, cyber unmanned capabilities, and the like. It was also notable because he said he would leave troops in the Middle East, mostly with a counterterror focus, 1,500 to 2,000, which is the first time he's been specific about that. But they would have no role in political meddling in other countries. So stepping back, in Obama-like, from being a political actor in the region, focused on things like National Guard strengthening and the participation of transgendered LGBTQ folks in the military. But here's the deal. We're talking about, you know, the weenie point I often make, which is it real growth or is it any growth at all? Here's the problem, fundamentally, and here's the reason that I think anything he says about defense budgets at this point is campaign, but not reality. And that is that the White House will do the first budget, the whole budget of this next administration. It's a point I've made before. They will do it because there will not be policy-making officials in charge in the agencies, and they will do it because that budget ostensibly has to be delivered first week in February. So the White House has to do it just as they did in the first Obama term, just as they had to do in the first Clinton term when I was there. And when they get to that set of discussions, what will be on the table is exactly what Byron was saying. It's a COVID, COVID, COVID. And it will be campaign promises, infrastructure, state assistance, unemployment insurance, healthcare changes. All of those things have budgetary implications. And the White House will be the center of the decision about trade-offs. It will not be in the Pentagon. It will very likely, I think, be a top-line level discussion that will set a top line wherever it sets it. I'm still predicting that it will be either in real terms or in absolute terms a cut, not a major one, because they are simply going to face so many promises and so many problems that they are going to have to balance what is provided as a top line to defense against the things that are promised by the candidate or demanded in American society when that president, if it's Biden, takes office. So he has tied his hands elsewhere. But it's not surprising that in the heat of a campaign, he would not announce that he was going to cut the defense budget. That's just sacrificing a constituency unnecessarily. The real game is going to be played if he's elected starting January 20th.
And I want to try to get to that broader constituency question in a moment. Mackenzie?
To Byron's excellent point. So this year, and Michael's, this year, Secretary Esper has said he has 2% points less buying power for the budget that was, quote, flat. If you put it in inflationary terms, it's actually a 4% decline. So to give everyone a sense, and that's to the total top line, but as Byron noted, it disproportionately hits procurement, right? Because we all know operations and maintenance and personnel are the accounts that are harder, squishier to get at. What's really interesting is the comments, again, from the conferences around town this week, General Murray and General Hino, both said something because as they talked about a day of reckoning coming, and they mean basically what I think is what Commander Salamander calls the terrible 20s, right? Where all of the major systems that were procured in the Reagan buildup are all coming of age and to be replaced at around the same time this decade. And there's not enough money to do it, right? But both of the generals said they want to make it profitable for prime contractors to sell new platforms to the military instead of maintaining old ones. And I think you're going to see this theme continue throughout next year, regardless of the administration. Sustainment, there's too much incentive for contractors to want to continue to maintain old stuff because there's money there. And the department needs new stuff, not new old stuff. And there seems to be a growing awareness by uniform leadership that this is an incentive structure that's wrong and that they have to figure out how to change it.
Dov, let me ramp that into the president's to get you to start off the conversation on the president's tough week or tough couple of weeks when it comes to civil-military relations. We talked a little bit about it in terms of the polling a few weeks ago. Obviously, then there was the Atlantic story while we were off talking about how news report quoting sources close to the president about how he is alleged to have disparaged military members, both dead and alive, as suckers and losers. That created a lot of outrage, a little bit imperceptible outrage. Michael, we can talk to you a little bit about that, or maybe, you know, maybe less outrage on the part of Republican members, certainly. And it's a conversation that we did have with former Pentagon acquisition chief Frank Kendall and Jim Mattis's former communications director, Buzz Snodgrass, both former military members, to talk a little bit about the chain of command implications for the president of the United States saying, you know, generals want war to make money for defense contractors, which is something extraordinary, puts all general officers, you know, and you can understand how the president would want to do that. Concerns about how it plays for the base. I'm trying to help the little guy, throwing general officers under the bus. And it's bizarre because at the end of the day, the military goes to war on decisions made by civilians. They don't go to war on their own. Talk to us a little bit about whether or not any of this really matters and how it affects the debate going forward. We heard, I think you said it, right? People have already decided. I think Trump could probably shoot somebody, as he claimed, on, you know, at high noon on Fifth Avenue and still wouldn't, you know, be charged with anything. I think the GOP has shown it is armor plating around the president to make, you know, I mean, right? The criticisms weren't what he said about the virus to Bob Woodward. It was getting mad at Lindsey Graham for talking the president into talking to Woodward, right? It's never the infraction. It's about, you know, atmospherics around the size of it. A, what does this civil military spat mean? Does it mean anything? And does it change anything in 5 weeks? Because it doesn't seem to me, you know, the president's gaining ground in Michigan. It doesn't, like, I don't think any of this is affecting anything at this point, aside from we spend time talking about it.
Well, you know, I don't know whether I should credit the president or he accidentally lucked out. But he refocused the whole civil military debate from the Atlantic article, which essentially dissed anybody who puts on the uniform and could have lost him a ton of votes, not just for military people, but from every family that has a military person or had a military person in any of our previous wars. He managed, again, I don't know if it was deliberate or he was just lucky, but now the focus is no longer on the ordinary, you know, buck private. Now the focus is on the generals. Well, there aren't all that many generals and admirals who vote relative to the military as a whole or to people who had people who served in the military. So if it wasn't an election issue before, and it may not have been because a lot of people have made up their minds, it's certainly not going to be one now because he has the focus, you know, the press being what they are, you guys in the media, you're focusing on the latest story. And the latest story is no longer the Goldberg article and all military people being suckers, but rather it's all these corrupt generals and admirals who are looking for their jobs in industry. And that's plays to a very, very smaller constituency in terms of those being concerned. And the larger constituency, well, they don't care. I mean, for all you know, they think he's right. So he's in a way, he's kind of lucked out. The problem really isn't the issue, I should say, is not really the election. It is the impact of all of this stuff on military morale. As we were discussing before you went on the air, there are kids out there who are being fired at, shot at, wounded, killed as we speak. And the impact of all of this on military morale, on how they perform in the field, on whether, because they're so upset about all of this, they're not going to be as good as they can be and will get shot at because and hurt because of it. To me, that's the biggest problem. What he is really doing is putting our kids at risk. And he, of course, has no empathy, no understanding. And when it comes to the military, he really does believe they're a bunch of suckers. which doesn't exactly help the kid who's being fired at by either a terrorist or a Russian or whoever.
Look, the Goldberg article, I think, had resonance for a lot of people because we've heard glimmers of this. I'm smarter than the generals. You guys are all morons. You know, we'd heard the story about him meeting with Dunford and saying, wow, he's a really smart guy. Why is he in the military? Right. I mean, that seems to be right. I mean, some of these stories have a lot of traction because they have these elements that are in there.
Vago, they have traction with the military. Whether they have traction with the voters is a different issue because he's now going after the people with stars on their shoulders.
Correct.
And now not everybody relates to them.
And the Army Chief of Staff, somebody I think we all have a lot of respect for, has to get out there and say, hey, look, you know, this isn't the case. You know, Dove, you and I were talking about senior leaders who may be considering resigning over this and whether or not they will ultimately. I want to talk about 9/11, but, you know, who wants to weigh in on this element of the conversation? Because I think it is really important. It is incredibly damaging. But it's, you know, at the end of the day, if it doesn't move a needle on what happens in November, we could be in for another 4 years of this, which will be, right, even more damaging. I think everybody recognizes. So where does anybody want to take it? Gordon?
Let me suggest, I mean, I agree up to a point with what Dove had to say about the impact on military morale. There's not any question in my mind about that. I rather suspect this president has had that impact for the last 3.5 years as he's gone through these multiple steps of dissing the military over time. But I'm not sure that he's right about it's no longer being an issue in the campaign. And let me say what I mean by that. The issue is leadership. Okay, that's what really the issue is. The biggest foreign policy, national security issue in any presidential campaign is the credibility of the leader, right? Not the particular policy, not confront China, not confront Russia, not do high-tech weapons, not cut or raise the defense budget. It really comes down to leadership. So in 2004, when the Bushies succeeded in undermining John Kerry, it was about his capacity as a leader. That's what the swift voting was all about, was undermining his capacity as a leader, and it worked, right? This is the moment that we are at here. This is about the credibility of Donald J. Trump as a leader, as the steward of American national security and American foreign policy. And I think that's where this issue is going to cut electorally. So I don't think the issue is dead by some artful waltzing by the president, probably totally accidental waltzing by the president. But in fact, the underlying issue here, which is this person holding the top office in the land a credible leader, whether it comes to COVID, whether it comes to domestic economy, whether it comes to foreign policy, that's the biggest issue. And that's, I think, what's important about the approach that the Biden campaign seems to be taking, which is the steadiness of leadership issue. But not so much about respect for the troops or not respect for the troops. It's about this person may or may not know how to be a leader. That, I think, has great electoral heft. So I don't think the issue's dead.
Michael, I know you want to weigh in on this, especially how GOP members are taking this, given how mute the party has become over any and all such issues.
Well, I mean, first, I don't think they really had much of a chance to react as the news cycle has gone so fast over the last 2 weeks. I mean, first, there were obviously the comments by the president, you know, calling dead servicemen and women, you know, losers and suckers. And I think that people on the Hill were kind of caught off guard by his attacks on generals and the defense industry, because it's almost like he's doubling down. It was a direction that I think don't think anybody expected. And it seems like it's very personal with him because he came into office very enamored with generals. You know, he surrounded himself with people like General Kelly, General Mattis, General McMaster. And I think he felt that their loyalty would be to him instead of their loyalty being to the country. And with things not working out, I think that the shine has worn off. And the only general he seems to still be enamored with is General Flynn. And I think the fact that the Woodward revelations came out so quickly after didn't really give people on the Hill a chance to really respond. But obviously, I think Democrats and Republicans alike, you know, feel the same way about this. You know, that they understand that as I think you said or somebody else said earlier, that, you know, civilians are the ones who decide whether we go to war. I mean, even the president's son has chimed in on this. Don Jr. tweeted, that we should ban generals from serving on the boards of defense contractors. And if we did, we'd be out of Afghanistan in 5 minutes. I mean, just makes no sense. There's a lot of head scratching and eye rolling on Capitol Hill right now.
It's one thing to eye roll. It's another thing to weigh in on something like this. Very quickly, Byron, you know, you've been watching this space for a while as an analyst and a historian, and then Mackenzie very quickly, because it is 9/11, and I do want to spend a little bit of time talking, you know, sort of getting an update on where we are. But any thoughts you guys have on this and the, you know, sort of patent absurdity of some of these comments? I mean, there's no other way for me to say it.
You know, I was across the street from the World Trade Center when 9/11 occurred. So it's always an interesting and very somber day. You know, I think maybe thinking, you know, how this last 19 years have progressed. Where do I go with this? Maybe thinking from that day forward, it's really kind of remarkable that we've not had.
Byron, if you're going to launch off on that, I was talking more on the civil military relations side.
You're more
than welcome to.
You know, no, I find the whole thing. The one thing that I'll say, it didn't appear to weigh at all on defense stocks and defense sentiment. I think, you know, it was really just an issue that investors in defense contractors have largely ignored.
Mackenzie, any last thoughts before we go to the 9/11 question? And
only that I would only say that it's just kind of silly, because absurd, as you mentioned, Vago, but really kind of silly, because this president is pretty staunchly supportive of industry. I mean, how many times has he stood by the CEOs of various defense contractors in the Rose Garden and elsewhere, constantly tweeting about, you know, different weapons programs, touting foreign military sales this past year in particular. So, I would just chalk it up to what Gordon called, you know, election season.
I was going to mention that he enjoys being surrounded by defense executives. He loves going to defense plants, taking credit for defense spending, utterly rebuilding the U.S. military, and then pushing arms sales through, even over the protests of people in his own administration sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, and then saying, I'm so good to you guys in industry. We're on the 19th anniversary of 9/11. Dove, you were in the building at the time when that happened. Byron, your old office used to be across the street from the World Trade Towers. I remember a couple of times meeting you at the top of the town for drinks, not all that long before, frankly, that event. I had my high school graduation dinner there and remember when the building was being built. Here we are 19 years afterwards. If you look at Iraq, it's an absolute mess. Libya is in chaos. Assad is in charge in Syria. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban's about to take control again and has made abundantly clear that there's going to be a reckoning, and made it also equally clear that, you know, where they stand on rights for women and music. I mean, it's almost like we find ourselves all the way back there. We haven't had a major attack on U.S. soil. On the other hand, I think if any nation had been killing 800 Americans or 1,000 Americans a day for 6 months, we would already have been at war with them. So, you know, Dove, let's start out with, you know, sort of where are we? Because I think there are a lot of people who add all of this stuff up at the end of the day, and we're sort of also commemorating the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, which arguably was the last war the U.S. sort of did right, I guess. But even though the sins of that have kind of come back to us a little bit in some forms as well, you know, sort of where are we? You know, on a day of reflection, where are we? And I kind of quickly want to go around the horn with all of you. And then Byron, you as well, because of the personal nature of all of this.
Well, you mentioned the word sin, and I think that's really where we're at. The original sin, and I wrote a book about this, was that we took our eye off Afghanistan. I was actually in Germany and was flown back with a whole bunch of other people. We arrived on 9/12. We went straight to the Pentagon to hear the president pretty much say we would go into war. And then I went around the back of the Pentagon and I see these people picking up body parts, because they were these huge plastic bags. and there were hands, and there were heads, and there were limbs, and nobody knew what belonged to whom. You just dumped it in the bag. And I'll take that with me to my grave, that image. But what happened was that instead of simply finishing the story in Afghanistan, where after a year and a half, 2 million people who had left for Pakistan had come back, small businesses were opening up, the Taliban was nowhere to be seen, Al-Qaeda was on the run, we went and got involved in another war, which we needn't have gotten involved in. And we are paying the price today for both of those. And if I sound a little emotional, it's because I am, because of all the people. Forget about the money. I don't care about the money. I care about all the people whom I saw in Walter Reed and then in Bethesda who lost arms and legs and stomachs and eyes. And those are the ones that lived. That's the legacy we've got. And we're still paying the price today.
Byron, that was kind of a tough day for you as well. I was supposed to actually be in the Pentagon that day. And if it wasn't for one of my office mates calling me, I would have been at Navy, been waddling up the corridor to Navy Public Affairs with literally a jet chasing me because my meeting was supposed to be there at 9:30. But
well, look, when the second tower was hit, I walked out and like a lot of people just started walking north through Manhattan. And, one of the more poignant things that I remember was being in Washington Square and an F-15 came over and started circling. And I guess this was after the first tower had fallen, the second tower hadn't fallen yet. But a New York City crowd, which normally, you wouldn't think is very pro-military, burst out in cheers. That, kind of the help had arrived. I agree with Dove's comments, about, wow, this thing really took us in so many different directions. And I'm also reminded, though, that, I think Rumsfeld had a, was it a quadrennial defense review? I know it was a major defense review, that we were going to skip a generation of procurement and kind of focus on R&D. And it really wasn't called great power competition, but it was definitely kind of focusing on a high-end fight. And maybe that's the one caveat from 9/11 is how quickly we think we can disengage from the Middle East and kind of these messy, messy events that were probably another major terror event away from having to revisit some of these things. And I absolutely think the military recognizes that. I'm not always sure that investors recognize it, but you just don't know what the future is going to hold. And maybe that's one of the more important lessons from 9/11. You've got to be agile and flexible.
Michael, Mackenzie, and then let's end with Gordon.
So, we all remember where we were on that day. And for me, it was my wife was working in the U.S. Senate at the time. And it was her first day back at work after maternity leave. Was 9/11. And I remember calling her after the plane hit the second tower because my instincts were that this was not over yet and telling her she's got to get home. And our bedroom window looked out in the direction of the Pentagon. I remember seeing for 2 weeks, smoke rising every morning when we woke up. And, the sad part too, there are lots of sad parts, but recently, watching Republicans, especially our president, embrace somebody like Marjorie Greene as a rising star in the Republican Party. And she's been a denier of whether a plane did or did not hit the Pentagon. And, that's the sad part about the diminishing of truth and the rise of fake news that we've seen over the last 4 years that I think we need to do everything in our power to fight.
It's amazing because I, like so many other people, heard the boom of the airplane hit the building. You knew an airplane hit the building. Like, how could you even, right? How is that even subject for debate and one of a number of just absolutely repulsive conspiracy theories that are out there. Mackenzie?
Yeah, so it was my first day on the job at the Pentagon. I was waiting in the badge office to get access to the building as like a kid. I'm so young. Shiny, fresh-faced kid from Georgia. So yes, like Dr. Zakheim, I too will have a lot of those images in my mind forever, but not the kind that he saw. It was more about you know, coming back into work when we were allowed in about like 8-9 days later, you know, you could smell the smoke every day and you understood how long that was going to persist and that, you know, they've roped off the area of impact. But then you started seeing signs of hope and encouragement from people all over the country, like kids from Columbine High School. And they were supporting us who worked in the building and they'd been through their own traumatic events. So I take away, sort of an optimistic view that of Americans in general when I reflect on it in that sense. But, you know, what's remarkable in today, I think there's, you know, we've talked several times about reckoning in this conversation this morning. And what's interesting is if you look at the polling and the data from multiple places about members of the armed forces or recently departed service members and veterans, they overwhelmingly want to be done without Iraq and Afghanistan. And it seems as if the only bastion left of support for continuing indefinitely is in Washington, in both parties. And I think that that's something that politicians in particular are going to have to come to terms with sooner than later, because it's going to affect the ability of politicians to use force in the near future or not to address meaningful problems that probably would justify it. But I think that until they have this difficult conversation with themselves and each other, they're going to find a surprising reaction from the generals when next time they want to go to go take proactive measures.
Gordon?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking, this is the first American election where kids who were born after 9/11 get to vote, 18-year-olds, as it was 19 years ago. And for them, this is history. So to remind myself of the fact that it wasn't history this morning, I watched the whole hour of NBC news tape from 9/11, just to remind myself. Right. And I have to tell you, it unsettled me extremely, almost as much as it did the first time I saw it happen. And the first time I saw it happen was I was in the deputy director of CBO's office talking about budgets and the defense budget. And somebody ran in from the director's office and said a plane has just hit a second tower. So we raced into his office and watched it from CBO's office down near the Capitol and in shock, and then were evacuated from the building. So the legacy of that is emotionally real. It's as real. It's one of those things that you remember where you were, like John F. Kennedy's assassination, which I was also very much alive for, and is history to a lot of people. But I know exactly where I was. And so it has that kind of heavy impact. And I'm sure it did on policymakers too. But, and that this is what I think the legacy is. The invasion of Iraq was a massive strategic error. I think Dove's right. It took the eye off the ball in Afghanistan, and that in turn launched an enterprise that I think has undermined American leadership and American power and American credibility around the world. It cost a bunch of lives. It cost, still counting the veterans' dollars, well over $6 trillion. It undermined our leadership. It institutionalized a huge counterterror, counterinsurgency enterprise across the intelligence community and parts of the Defense Department and some of the rest of the government, including the State Department. And in executing the strategy, it put the military into tasks and responsibilities they manifestly could not do well, as almost every report from the Special Inspectors General for Afghanistan and Iraq have amply documented over the past 18 years. The consequence of that for America's position and America's leadership in the world has been staggeringly negative, and it is still going on today. You know, despite any endless wars rhetoric, we are still involved through special operations forces in lots of exercises where the military is still being put in those roles, where we're still engaged in that kind of intrusion, and it's all the legacy of 9/11.
I remember, Gordon, you having a debate before the Iraq war, and so many people, others on the panel were saying, oh, it'll be over really quickly in a blink of an eye. And you said, this is going to cost trillions of dollars. It's going to take our eye off the ball with China, Russia, and any one of a number of other countries, and it's going to constitute a big strategic long-term issue for the United States that'll cost us trillions, and that still resonates.
I stand on that record. I opposed the invasion of Iraq. I did not oppose the retaliation in Afghanistan, and I think Dove is absolutely correct. Because we diverted to Iraq, we completely took our ball, right, our eye off the ball in Afghanistan, and I said so at the time.
Well, and the thing about it is, right, these actions have implications, right? So we didn't really get serious about Afghanistan by 2010, and that was already too late.
Too late.
And those experiences then color an inability to act, for example, in Syria, for wanting to not get involved in a third war, or Libya. And as a consequence, then you have other issues that you haven't dealt with. And I do remember the two F-16s that went over the Potomac. I remember went over Key Bridge and Byron very similarly. You know, there's a big cheer that came up at the end of the day. Everybody, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. We've gone a little bit long on this special episode. Appreciate you all staying with us, and look forward to having you guys back on next week as we continue the dialogue and continue our analysis. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.